Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, welcome back. My next guest started cleaning mansions, but she's moved into a more challenging speciality, from sorting out the homes of hoarders to cleaning up what are called trauma scenes. Now, these are crime scenes. These are literally places where sometimes murders have happened and other deaths as well. So at this point, I want to give you the warning that this could be a difficult subject matter for some people, so your listener discretion is advised. But I don't want to put you off entirely from our guest, a fascinating guest, Alana Gillan. You're very welcome.
Thank you.
This is you. Your job is absolutely incredible. I didn't know your job existed.
Well, that's the thing. You don't know that I exist until you need me.
Is there a name, on a particular technical name on your job? Or?
I would describe it as a sort of an umbrella term of biohazard crime scene and trauma cleaning, and sort of all the things that fall underneath that.
Yeah. And it's a really difficult job, trauma cleaning. Who hires you then?
So it can be anyone from family members, neighbours, anyone that owns property. If it's a scene that has happened, say there's an accident has happened in a community place, then it's sort of facilities management. So it can be anybody really that needs a service.
Workplaces and so on.
Yeah,
so anything
yeah.
where blood has been spilled, really,
yeah,
isn't it? Because
yeah,
that's where you're a specialist.
Yeah.
How do you get into something, an area like this? Because it is specialised and there is a technical skill and education yeah. required, I presume.
Yes, I always tell people that it was a series of unfortunate events that led me to,
really?
to where I am today. But yes, I did have to go and get qualified and different courses and things and just have a general interest. But I built up from having a domestic cleaning company, first of all, and got very bored cleaning and dusting ornaments and in the same place.
There was a big mansion, big houses.
Yes, and small houses too. I did one bedroom flats to seven bedroom mansions with swimming pools and their own private bars. All very boring.
That's not boring at all. I'd love to snoop around people's mansions and see how they live and judge them on where all the filth is.
It has always just reassured me that I do not want a big house.
Is that right? Okay.
I don't want to have to clean
because
all
of
that.
The cleaning, yeah. Or even having to pay someone to clean it.
That's it.
Or probably just not use. There are probably rooms you're dusting out
for. Yeah, absolutely. You have big, massive houses that people never go into rooms and it's always, that's the good room or that's the party room or that's the seven spare bedrooms that's never ever used, but sure, clean it every week anyway.
Oh my God. And all over the country.
All over the country.
So, and that came out of, I think you were you working in restaurants and then the crash happened?
Yeah, absolutely. I was worked in hospitality from I was about 14, 15, washing dishes, serving tables, worked my up to a restaurant manager, and the sort of the crash happened in 2012 and sort of realised.
But you were a get up and go get at it, aren't you, so you set up your own cleaning company?
Two children and bills to pay, so it was a case of sink or swim, and it was there wasn't any jobs, and I sort of really started to panic of what can I do, and I was like, I'm not bad at cleaning, maybe give that a go.
And where did you, because you obviously were sick and tired of cleaning these empty mansions, where did the idea of becoming the trauma scene cleaner come from?
So in 2017, a book came out called The Trauma Cleaner,
right.
And it was a lady in Australia, Sandra Pankhurst, who had set up a trauma cleaning company.
Yeah.
She was married to an undertaker and realised that there was no one to actually clean up after the deaths, and I was fascinated by her book, and I suppose that was my light bulb moment. Although I do have a best friend whose partner says that he gave me the idea, although I can never remember that conversation, but he still swears that it was his
success
idea.
Success has many fathers, yeah.
But it was really, it was a book, and it was a crossroads of the cleaning company. I was bored and didn't really know what else to do. I wanted to go in a different direction, and I thought about coming away from the cleaning industry altogether. But once I'd read that book, I knew that that was my calling.
This got you interested. And it requires a calling because, as you mentioned, it's biohazard and trauma scene cleaning. What's the training like for this?
So there's different types of training. I've done two sets of training. I went to Nelson College, Nelson and Cogan College in Manchester, first of all, and I did some City and Guilds training in biohazard, crime scene and trauma cleaning. And that covered everything from IV needle sweeps to fogging long before COVID arrived.
And that was the fog that kills everything.
Yeah, so we were trained in that there. And then in 2021, I decided to go to Ultima Cleaning in Bristol. They're actually based in Wales, but their college, their academy is in Bristol.
Yeah.
And I got trained up with them for 3 days just to reassure myself that I was doing the right thing and sort of what I'd been taught before was still relevant. And up to date, and I'll probably look into something else again soon. But I try to do different courses and keep up to date quite regularly.
So it's a serious job because obviously you're cleaning up after you're cleaning up disturbing scenes where someone has died. You're dealing with the bereaved families as well. So if in the case of just what we'd call a normal death, I suppose, the funeral directors have come in, they've removed the body. There is still cleanup always to be required there. But I presume when a crime has occurred and there is blood, that's when it gets very tough.
Yeah. So crime scene cleaning, again, is an umbrella term. So that's anything that kind of involves body fluid cleanup. It doesn't necessarily have to be a murder. It can also be a break-in or domestic violence, things like that there, which can lead to body fluids needing cleaned up in certain scenes. Not everyone gets the privilege of passing away peacefully in bed, and sometimes deaths can be quite traumatic. Sometimes people aren't found. And it's the length of time or what has happened before that. And it's not just blood, it could be decomposition and things like that there. So it's really important that you have a professional or a specialist to come in and clean that up and not attempt to do that yourselves. And families shouldn't have to do that themselves
they
either.
They shouldn't, no. Because obviously it's a biohazard. It's dangerous for people, isn't it? So you need to be
absolutely
equipped.
It would be classified as potentially hazardous waste. So even transporting that there, you have to have licenses and paperwork to follow all that up. It's not a case of giving it away a spray with some bleach and hoping for the best.
Yeah.
So it's quite important.
Your job is reassuring in that regard. But the difficult part for you, and I don't know what the training was like, because you're going into a house where sort of the official people of the state have kind of left at this stage, haven't they? I mean, there is a crime, forensics, their job is all done and everything. Yep. But the fluids are left behind, as you've put it. How do you deal with the families when you meet them at the doorstep?
So I have a great sense of empathy and just being able to chat to people and listen to them. I have cried with mummies. I have hugged people, you know, and I love that side of my job because I'm so genuine and I'm hurt for that person as well of what has happened to them. Sometimes I have come across men who have found their brother they haven't found them in a couple of weeks and they've just discovered their body and they're so upset and they blame themselves and they're angry or they're, you know, they've got this guilt and it's just listening to their story before you even put that forensic suit on, before you even enter the house. You know, they need to tell you.
Is that right?
Their story.
They want to talk to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's all part of it, not just going in and cleaning up, you know. And,
yeah, no, it's a huge part of it.
And it's listening. And, you know, if a person needs a hug, I'm all for that. And I will cry with people. I have cried with people.
Really?
So I'm such a softy.
I can see you're that kind of person. And then after all of that, you have to go and clean the scene.
And that's when sort of the task of, right, this is my job, you know, that bit clicks in. Then this is work now and you have to be professional. You put that suit on and you have to make sure your PP is correct. You have to make sure that all the procedures that you're doing is correct so you can sort of leave that personal touch at the door and pick that up again when you go
to speak. And you've explained to them what you're about to do.
And I always encourage them to kind of leave at that stage because they don't need to see me in a forensic suit. They don't need to see what's coming out of my cases to deal with sort of whatever's in front of
That's lovely that you take that care, because obviously when you dress up, you're fully covered, are you? And it can be a scary looking costume.
Yeah, and you know, it's such a traumatic thing to start off with. You don't need to have that visual there as well.
PPE clothing.
Yeah, and you're dealing with the visuals of death. You're dealing with the smells as well. Mm-hmm. And some people that have been in the house, they don't want to return into the house. You know, they can't face that.
Yes,
or,
yes.
And I've even been asked to go in and collect the shirt and tie from the wardrobe or look for a certain item of jewellery.
Right.
And I will do that for people. And I love doing that. You know, it's great. Part of my job satisfaction, that I've been helpful,
yeah,
that I've been useful, that I've been able to do that for someone.
You want people to be at peace, I suppose, in the area of your work. On the practical level then, how does one clean things like blood and bodily fluids?
Hard work.
Hard work, yeah.
There's no magic trick. We obviously have correct chemicals. There's special enzymes and things like that there. There's ozone machines. There's different equipment for different situations.
It's science-driven.
Science-driven, which has always been exciting for me. And I suppose years of my teachers pulling their hair out of me doing double award science for GCSE, it finally clicked in somewhere.
Very good. What's an
ozone machine is a machine that deals with odour. Electrically charges
yeah,
oxygen molecules, and it puts out unstable oxygen molecules. And then as that stabilises, it removes the odour and the bacteria back in as it stabilises.
Makes it easier for you to do your job as well.
Yeah, it replaces, and it does leave quite a strong chemical smell afterwards.
Right, but better
it's,
than.
It's better than, yeah, than the smell.
What's a forensic torch?
So the forensic torch is basically to reassure me that I've done my job properly, and that's not really for anyone else. I can go around with my special glasses and my little torch and I can see all manner of things, but as long as I have...
Okay, so that's the show that kind of stains and things, and that
shows body fluids.
You want to see that clear at the end.
Yep, and I'm not really too worried if there's anything else anywhere else, just in the area that I have
cleaned. Your job is done. Yes, as I say, you see some terrible trauma in the aftermath of that, and you told us you cry sometimes. The families, you must carry a lot of this away with you when you leave.
It's hard not to. Certainly I've dealt with situations where there has been young males that have committed suicide and you know, they've got mums and stuff there, and I'm a parent and I know that situation that you never want to be in. So you can't have this hard face. You can't, you know, not be affected by it. But at the same time, of years of being in that job, you do get desensitised, but I'm always aware not to be too desensitised to a sensitive situation,
if
that makes sense.
Yeah. Yes, it does, yeah.
So you have to have that kind of soft nature to kind of deal with it, but you can't be too soft that it would ultimately affect your own mental health.
Are you going in with a team or are you...
Sometimes, but 95% of the time it's myself.
That's how sensitive it is, so really just one
yeah,
person.
Yeah, and I feel that I can provide a better service one-on-one going in. You know, you don't have a massive team coming in. You don't have all these people stomping around, you know, your son's room or your brother's bedroom or, you know, your wee granny's hall, which is maybe falling down the stairs. You don't need, you know, four or five people in doing that. And if it takes me half a day by myself, then I'll make sure that that's done and that's the case.
It's incredible. Your work is unbelievable. How old are your own kids now?
19 today for my son.
Oh, my God. Happy birthday.
And
there.
My daughter is 17.
17. So with teenage kids, you know, only too well, you can empathise with parents, you know, because it's a mental illness.
Absolutely.
It's a disease really in the country that leads to death by suicide. I mean, it
Absolutely.
Is enormously difficult.
Absolutely. And you sort of in my job, you're very aware of it. And it's the same if I've been called out to, say, some squat and squalor situations where there's been drug use or there's needles and things there as well.
Okay,
I'm so aware of the other side of sort of the underbelly of the world, and sort of coming home and you're constantly kind of drumming that into the kids, you know, this is what I saw today. Trying to keep them the right track and not traumatise them.
Yes, it's a delicate balance, isn't it? Yeah, because there are addiction issues, there are illnesses out there,
yeah.
And you're confronted them, like a lot of frontline workers, I suppose, in a way.
Absolutely.
Seeing the real world.
Yeah, and I come in after those guys, so I suppose the emergency services, they see a lot worse than what I do. I'm just cleaning up the aftermath of it.
Yeah. It can be worse though for you, because you're kind of imagining it, aren't you?
That's it. You're kind of piecing together your own story from it. So I suppose I like to think I'm a little bit of a detective now and again.
I wonder about that, because we know about forensics and people are obsessed with, you know, photographing a blood splatter and the incredible story that they can tell, and how important that is when it comes to, you know, putting justice into action. Are bloodstains removable, by the way?
From certain materials and things, and it depends. Many, many factors, you know, how long it has been there for, how much is there, where it has come from as well, part of the body has come from, and things like that there. So, So it just depends on the surfaces and things, what chemicals you can use to break down that compound and kind of remove it, or if it's just to the stage where it's too contaminated and it can't be cleaned properly or safely.
Without leaving some trace behind.
Yeah,
okay.
So in that case then I would remove things, and sometimes you sort of think to yourself that you've removed the personality of someone's home. If there's like an area or something, you've had to cut carpet, or you've had to, you know, remove a sofa, or, you know, you've had to cut a bit of wood out of the sort of skirting boards and things like that there.
I see.
Sometimes that in itself can kind of be quite shocking for someone to come back into.
Find a piece missing, yeah.
So
And as a cleaner, is that your job as well to do that?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Because it's contaminated. It's my job to make sure that there is no contamination left at all.
And disposed of.
Disposed of.
The licensed way that you mentioned.
Absolutely. And then we have a lovely team of painters and joiners and everybody else that comes in behind that can fix those if the families wish it. Or sometimes it's a case of it's a landlord, you know, and there is no family, and the sort of the house has to be put back right for the next tenants coming in.
Yeah, and in hopes that they don't know what's happened, isn't it?
Well, if I've done my job right, they won't know.
They won't know. Talk to us about hoarders, because that's another area of a specialised area as well of yours too. And we see all the stuff on newspapers and on the telly about hoarders. You don't think that's a proper illustration of what goes on?
Not at all. Sometimes I get quite frustrated with sort of how it's portrayed on TV, and I wish it could be done in 3 days and all of a sudden everything's painted white and it's over and done with. I have clients that I could be working with for 3 weeks. I have clients I've been working with for 2 years, 3 years, and it's just breaking down those barriers, and a lot of it is trauma related as well. There's triggers there, you're working through that. A lot of the people that I've worked with, they're obviously suffering with different mental health disorders, conditions, and there's reasons behind everything. And I hate the fact that people think it's just laziness, it's definitely not. And I have a way of saying that, you know, mess is morally neutral. It doesn't make you a good person or a bad person just because you can clean your house.
Tidy house does not denote
it really, really
moral
doesn't.
Goodness.
Exactly. And shame is the enemy of function. So whenever you're hiding in your home and you're hiding things from friends and families, it paralyzes you as well. And that overwhelmness, it spirals out of control and it freezes you. And I would describe a lot of my clients as being comfortably numb.
Right, yes.
And it's just, you talk about clutter blindness. So, you know, you've got loads of things sitting on your desk and eventually you don't see that. And that kind of does happen in home as well. Like your brain is blocking those things out because it's trying to like help you. It's trying to protect you from your own surroundings. But then it eventually does the opposite, where you no longer realise how bad your surroundings are, and it's affecting not only your mental health but your actual physical health, and a lot of people end up very sick because of the conditions. You know, there's rotten food, there could be pests.
When you were involved, then I presume you're being referred to by psychologists or people involved in mental health?
So, yes, the mental health teams can sort of give me a call and they make a referral, and we have like a lovely little document that they fill out, and we sort of check boxes and sort of make sure that they're on the our sort of criteria. We don't go in and just
sort of arrive one day. Yeah. Yes, a lot of issues have to be worked through, obviously.
Absolutely. And sometimes for those people, I could be the first person inside their home in years. You know, they've stopped the social workers coming in, or
course, yeah.
You know, and it's just breaking down those barriers of I'm not the enemy, and I'm not going to just randomly throw all your stuff out. And I always try and get some of the people to do a little exercise. You know, people ask me, oh, how does that happen? Or can you not just go in and throw it all away? And I always get people to think, if I went into your bedroom right now and completely took everything out of it, all your personal items, your pictures, your jewellery, anything that made any sort of sentimental value to you, and took it all away because it didn't mean anything to me and it's just clutter, you wouldn't be very happy, would you?
No, the stuff that tells somebody's story.
So just because their whole house is completely filled with stuff, you know, rubbish, collectibles, just random things, it doesn't mean that they don't have any attachment to that. There's a reason that that's there, and it's about breaking down those reasons and finding out, right, well, what can we do with this? Things, what should we do with this? And letting them know that they deserve to live in a better condition as well, yeah. to keep themselves healthy.
So by the time you arrive, they're sort of open to this. Is it a very slow process to take apart?
Very slow process. Some people that I would be with, it could take them months to even let me in the door. We can have little chats on the doorstep, we can have chats over the phone. Usually by the time they come to me, it's the end of the line. So they could be facing eviction, they could be facing different sort of bodies, like environmental health, you know, would be pushing for certain things, and they're coming to me. It's like, this is the last stop. I'm here to help, or further actions going. So, but what we're trying to do, what I'm trying to do in campaign over the last couple of years, is to make me not the last stop, to get me further up the chain.
I see, yeah.
To try and help people before it gets to the...
Because by the sounds of things, we've come to know you over the last 20 minutes or so, that you're like a therapist yourself.
Yes.
You would have been an amazing therapist, by the way.
Thank you very much.
You were so good at that.
You sort of have to be a chameleon. You have to blend into all situations, and you have to find that common ground and have a chat with people and kind of, you know, get on that one-to-one. But no qualifications in that area, although I did recently, I went on to Open University, and I've just completed a wee course in trauma and just counselling.
Wow.
And that's my first step to actually putting some of my nonsense into paperwork.
It's not nonsense, you have something more important, which is the experience of chatting to people.
That's it. It just happened that sort of the paperwork to back that up, to know that I'm not doing any more damage.
You love your job.
I absolutely love my job. I couldn't be happier. And I know it's sort of grim in places, but I don't ever see it that there. I have such great job satisfaction and genuinely getting to help people in the worst possible situations.
Absolutely, yeah. Because it seems grim, but I mean, it's like, you know, a surgeon's job can be grim, but they're doing good things for people and nurses and so on. And you're just part of that whole chain, which gives us kind of faith sometimes, isn't it? Because there are good people out there who want to help.
There's a whole host of people that will be involved in the situations before me, but I just kind of think, because I am the last stop, if I'm the last person and I can help and sort of make it better, then they're going on to face further sort of heartache or whatever, but I've made that small bit better and I've been able to fix a little bit for them,
yeah,
I suppose.
Alana Gillan, we now know what a biohazard and trauma cleaner is. Are you cleaning today, by the way?
I'm going to go and clean my granny's house today.
Who's very much alive. And
yes.
So this is something you have to do.
I've been on holiday for 2 weeks and she's not impressed that the dustbin won't do itself. So I have a VIP guest booked in this afternoon.
So you're obviously brilliant still at the regular cleaning.
She's very good at humbling me.
She doesn't insist on an ozone machine.
No, but if I don't get the lines in the carpet right, I'll definitely hear about it.
Alana, it's an absolute pleasure. Thanks for coming in to chat to us today.
Thank you so much.
And continue enjoying your job. It's always good to meet someone who loves their job.
Thank you.
Look after yourself. 51551, that's our text.
Email oliver@rte.ie.